Good evening. Good evening. My name is William Moak, and I'm the curator of Charles Dickens' The Key to Character at the New York Public Library. Oh, thank you. And you're joining us tonight in the South Court Auditorium for a lecture about Great Expectations. Next week, at the same time, Professor Gerhard Joseph from the City University of New York will be talking about Dickens, Scrooge, and autobiography. And if you're not aware of it, the last 2 weeks of December at the Museum of Modern Art, there is a film retrospective of Dickens' adaptations on film that's worth checking out. Go to MoMA.org. And of course, on Broadway, there's The Mystery of Edwin Drood. And for tonight, we have David Koenig with us from Rutgers University, who is going to be speaking of theater and the politics of style in Great Expectations. I had the pleasure of meeting David 2 years ago at the Dickens Boot Camp in Santa Cruz, where we focused on Great Expectations, and he delivered a wonderful lecture there on the late novel of Dickens, and I hope tonight's talk is an adaptation of that. David Koenig is an associate professor of English at Rutgers University, where his teaching focuses on 19th century literature and culture and the history of the novel. His first book was called Empty Houses, Theatrical Failure and the Novel. It was published by Princeton University Press. It examines the pivotal role played by failed theatrical projects in the careers of some of the major novelists in English, including Thackeray, George Eliot, Henry James, James Joyce, and Baldwin. A reviewer in the Times Literary Supplement in May, Peter Matthews, referred to David's book and its the boldness and originality of its arguments. That David's Koenig's book makes a valuable contribution not only to scholarship on the novelists as it considers, but also more widely to our understanding of the novel as a genre. Please join me in welcoming David Koenig.
Thanks so much. Which of these? Is this the? This one. Okay. Thanks so much for being here, and thank you, William, for that introduction and for inviting me. It's a little funny having this thing in front of me. I feel like I'm checking you all in for a flight somewhere. But I'll do my best to speak over it. If you guys haven't seen the exhibit that William has curated, I'm assuming most of you have, but it's really fabulous. He's also, these are not my images, but they're images from the exhibition that have to do with Great Expectations. So apparently they're going to change every 14 minutes or something. My talk's not that long, so you might only get to see two of them. But anyway, they're not keyed to what I'm talking about. They're just images from the exhibition that have to do with Great Expectations. Just quickly, I wanted to say that when I finished the book that William is talking about, a common question that I got was, why is Dickens not a part of it? And the easy kind of cop-out answer was that Dickens didn't form part of the book I wrote because that book was about people who, as my students would say, had issues with theater. That is, novelists who were drawn to the theater, but were not particularly good at writing for it, and didn't really have a theatrical inclination. And Dickens obviously doesn't fall in that category. He loved the theater, as many of you know. As a young man, he considered seriously being an actor instead of a writer. At the height of his career, height of his fame, he got really involved in what we call amateur theatricals, which doesn't really describe it, I think. These are really serious endeavors. This is not your like average charade party. These are like a lot of people involved in pretty serious theatrical endeavors, mostly for charity, but sometimes just not. They would often rent out big halls that they were actually covered by the press quite often. And Dickens was involved in writing, producing, directing these things, and of course starring in them. He spent the last decades of his life the lover of an actress, Ellen Ternan. He couldn't marry because he was already married, unhappily. And of course, most famously, as many of you will know, he spent the last about decade and a half of his life with a lot of time, an extraordinary amount of time devoted to these reading tours. And again, like amateur theatricals doesn't really cover what the theatricals were, these reading tours were not really readings in the sense of like Jonathan Franzen at Barnes & Noble reading from his book. These were intensely theatrical performances of set pieces from the novels. And incredibly famous for various kinds of violence. And one of the things I'll be talking about today is the way theatricality in Dickens moves around. And so when I say that these were kind of violent events, I mean, there was kind of violence all over the place. Maybe the most famous set piece of Dickens is reading tours was when he would do Sykes and Nancy, the murder of the prostitute Nancy by her pimp and lover, I suppose, Sykes from Oliver Twist, one of his earliest novels. And he would write, you know, in, to correspondence and stuff, killing Nancy again tonight with this kind of gleeful tone. And, you know, as many of you know, the readings were famous for a lot of people, mostly women, would faint during the readings, partly because the rooms were kind of close and crowded and hot, but also because they were sort of freaked out by the violence of the reading. So there would be, and Dickens himself would proudly note, you know, seven women carried out tonight or something, that he had sort of done, in a way, violence to these women as well. And of course, the other famous thing about the readings is that he was also doing a kind of violence to himself. The famous fact of that is that his, you know, blood rate was elevated to an insane degree, and his doctor kept pleading with him to stop these things. And it's pretty certain that these readings and his commitment to them hastened his early death at the age of 58. It's kind of terrifying to think that Dickens died at 58, since he did a lot more than you should be able to do in that short of time. He also, you know, he would, you know, there's a really terrific book about Dickens's theatrical performance, theatrical reading tours by a scholar called Malcolm Andrews, and he writes about the fact that Dickens, when he was killing Nancy in those sequences, he would bang his hand so incredibly hard on the podium that he would injure his hand on several occasions quite seriously and damage his gold cufflinks so that he couldn't use them anymore. So these were seriously, this was performance art, you know, much more Marina Abramowitz than Jonathan Franzen, I think. So I think we have to understand that. Anyway, this talk is about theatricality in Dickens, but in a slightly different register. So it's, in a way, it's a kind of elaborated footnote to the book I just published, trying to figure out what theater was for Dickens, what theatricality was. So all that stuff I just was talking about is in the background, but I'm going to be talking about something slightly different. Great Expectations, in particular. Great Expectations, as many of you know, is considered by many to be Dickens's masterpiece, his tightest and most psychologically subtle book. Unlike his sprawling multi-plot novels, Great Expectations is a character study relentlessly focused on the development of its narrator, Pip. We meet Pip, apologies for those of you who know the book well, but this is just a quick recap of what happens there. We meet Pip as a young orphan being raised by his brutal older sister and her improbably angelic husband, the blacksmith Joe Gargery, in the marshlands to the southwest of London. The novel charts Pip's relations with two older figures whose names have now become bywords for styles of frightening tutelage. Magwitch is the escaped convict Pip encounters and gives food to one day on the marshes, in the famous opening scene of the novel. Recaptured and sent to Australia, Magwitch eventually begins to secretly send Pip a steady income in repayment for the child's acts of kindness years earlier and promises of a much greater inheritance to come. Miss Havisham is the rich provincial woman whom Pip mistakenly thinks is his benefactor. Much of the text is occupied by the excruciating spectacle of Pip's craven rejection of his working-class family and his obsessive and snobbish and fairly creepy pursuit of the indifferent beauty Estella, who he thinks is sort of being primed by Miss Havisham to become his wife. Pip only surrenders these pretensions slowly and painfully after Magwitch returns to England, defying the death penalty to see once again the gentleman he has created in Pip. Great Expectations is, among other things, a novel about the narcissism involved in having a self, a novel about the self's blind reliance on a world whose shape and whose existence, even, it misrecognizes. Literary critics have given various names to this misrecognized world: the working class, the colonial periphery, the criminal underworld. And if the novel provides ample evidence for all of these interpretations, it's because I think the very narrative architecture of the book inscribes the experience of the self's equivocal centrality. The novel, I think, is a meditation on the status of first-person narration as an embodiment of the delusions of personal importance. We see this, I think, from the very first pages of the novel, the famous opening segment of the novel, where we meet Pip, as I've said, in a churchyard as he examines his family's tombstones. Celebrated for its atmospheric intensity and for the precision with which it recreates a child's consciousness, the scene is even more mysterious and I think much weirder than is often recognized. If we try to describe, for example, what's happening in the first scene of Great Expectations, we'll see that the novel, the text itself, provides at least two answers. This is the day, of course, that Pip meets Magwitch. But it is also the day that Pip receives what he calls, quote, my first most vivid and broad impression of the identity of things. What is the relation between these two events? Here's how the text coordinates them. My first most vivid and broad impression of the identity of things seems to me to have been gained on a memorable raw afternoon towards evening. At such a time, I found out for certain that this bleak place overgrown with nettles was the churchyard, and that Philip Pirrup, late of this parish, and also Georgiana, wife of the above, were dead and buried, and that the dark, flat wilderness beyond the churchyard, intersected with dikes and mounds and gates, with scattered cattle feeding on it, was the marshes, and that the low leaden line beyond was the river, and that the distant savage lair from which the wind was rushing was the sea, and that the small bundle of shivers, growing afraid of it all and beginning to cry, was Pip. "Hold your noise," called a terrible voice. Great Expectations begins with a wildly improbable coincidence. The very day, even the very moment, on which Pip comes to awareness of himself as an orphan, as a geographically situated existence, and as a name, in other words, as a social being, is also the day, the very moment, at which he meets the benefactor who will eventually give shape to that being. Odder still, Pip grows afraid of it all, in the words I've just quoted, just before Magwitch looms up to threaten him. It's as if Pip has first experienced the fear and then conjured a character to serve as a kind of container for it or give it a name. The implications of this possibility, I think, become stranger when we realize that what Pip has just become frightened of is not only his social identity, but the very topographical and geographical shape of the world, the marshes and the sea and the horizon beyond it. So that Pip seems to have produced Magwitch as a substitute for this apprehension of the sheer otherness of the world, its threatening difference from the self. If Magwitch is simply another name for everything that is not Pip, everything that surrounds him and precedes him, the novel suggests that being afraid of Magwitch is somehow preferable for Pip to being afraid of the world itself. Because anyway, how scary is Magwitch really? His main verbal tic is a promise to eat little Pip. If you remember, he's constantly commenting on how cute his fat cheeks are. He repeatedly turns Pip head over heels, swoops him onto tombstones and off of them. And here is how the novel describes his supposedly threatening interrogation technique. After each question, he tilted me over a little more so as to give me a greater sense of helplessness and danger. "You get me a file." He tilted me again. "And you get me whittles." He tilted me again. "You bring them both to me." He tilted me again. "Or I'll have your heart and liver out." He tilted me again. Oft-repeated but never realized threats to eat you up, a nicely timed sense of incrementally escalated physical play, a series of attentive questions. Magwitch sounds like nothing so much as everyone's favorite babysitter or uncle. He's a lot of fun, and the text clearly wants us to have fun with him. So where is this fun coming from? Where is it emanating from? We might be tempted to say that the scene's presentation is the adult Pip's, as is the awareness that Magwitch is essentially a benign figure, if a rough one. The ambiguity of tone, then, in which a kind of pleasure seeps through what is also obviously a frightening scene, would here be in the service of realism. This is just two perspectives on who Magwitch is. But I think the case is more complex than that and stranger. There's a peculiar insistence, almost a kind of mania, to the fun of this prose, and only some of it seems ascribable to Pip's adult psyche. The novel's language often flirts with this kind of excess that can border on emotional crassness or just exuberant irrelevance. One of the famous instances from a couple pages later in the novel is when Pip describes the fact that his sister and Joe Gargery have these kind of epic domestic battles in which his sister, in which Pip is employed as a connubial missile. He's sort of thrown between the two of them, or obviously his sister is usually the one who's doing the throwing. These kind of jokes, you're not quite sure what the point of them is. They seem a little bit off color to describe what is essentially a scene of domestic terror. Poking through the surface of the prose, then, is, I think, an energy that has little to do with any possible psychological motivation, any location in Pip's specific personality. But, of course, there's someone else here, someone I haven't really mentioned yet so far, and that's Dickens. It seems clear that it's this someone who accounts in the final analysis for this exuberance. The fun we are having is not really ascribable to Pip at all, but to his author. And this personage is perhaps the most mysterious yet. Oh, that's good. There's Magwitch. This personage, I think, Dickens, is perhaps the most mysterious yet. He has still to be explained. Each question I've asked so far then opens on another. What is happening in this scene quickly becomes a question about our narrator's agency. how in control of his experience is Pip? This question runs up against the sense that not everything in the text comes from Pip, that the comedy of the scene refers us not to the psychology called Pip, but to the writer called Dickens. But this in turn opens on another question, one that sounds fantastic, but that I mean quite seriously. What is Dickens? What more specifically is Dickens' style? What does it do to our sense of the meaning of this book? As we've seen, one way to describe the plot of the book is to say that it's about a character who discovers his lack of centrality to the workings of the world. The question I want to ask about is the relation between that story of a person who discovers his lack of centrality and a style that so loudly asserts its own scene-stealing centrality. If Dickens' style sits at an oblique angle to the events it narrates, the novel challenges us to work out the relation between this story and the mode in which it comes to us. One of the best critics of this mode is Robert Garris, who wrote a 1965 book, which is still one of the most excellent books on Dickens. I'm telling my students again, it's most excellent. It's called The Dickens Theater, and it draws attention to the sheer peculiarity of this writer. Garris argues that the extravagance of Dickens's manner interposes itself between the reader and the narrated action. He writes, "When Dickens is at his best, this odd thing happens. All the landscapes, all the dramatic scenes come to us in a voice in which we hear an infectious delight in what it itself is doing. The primary object of attention, as we read, is the great theatrical artist himself, who clearly wants his presence to be felt, who overtly and audibly performs before us some brilliant routines and contrivances in order to command attention and applause." As his title indicates, The Dickens Theater, Garris's claim is that Dickens's art is fundamentally theatrical, unabashedly showy, that is, and unconcerned to hide its contrivance. This prose is performing for us. And as much as Dickens wants us to care about what he's talking about, he also wants us to see how good he is at making us care about it. If we take Garris's analysis seriously, and I think we should, we have to confront the tension, maybe even the contradiction, embedded in the fact that this novel about the delusions of the expansive self is told by an exuberantly expansive narrative voice, that this tale about the limitations of agency is on another level a hymn to the boundlessness of agency. Understood this way, Dickens's unmissable, self-delighting style becomes an inverted shadow image of Pip's chastened self-understanding. This isn't, I think, the only way to understand the theatricality of Dickens' work in this novel in particular. And what I want to do today is think about the ways theatricality can be understood not only as Dickens's way of asserting his authorial presence for us, but also as a way on occasion of extinguishing it. I think it's Dickens' theatricality, in other words, that gives rise to two contradictory things we instinctively feel about his work: a sense that this writing speaks profoundly of the personality of one particular creative intelligence, and the sense, on the other hand, that this is writing of teeming democratic potential, the sense that anyone might find shelter in this representational universe. I think that is, to me, the contradiction of Dickens. He's unmistakably himself, and he's also the most capacious writer you could possibly imagine. And I think that's more of a kind of conundrum than we usually see. If Great Expectations is the most profound meditation on these questions in Dickens's work, I think this is paradoxically because of its interest in the psychological development and the limited perspective of its one single narrator. Great Expectations' intense preoccupation with the limitations of point of view also make it, I think, into a meditation on the address of literature, an investigation, that is, of the presumptive privacy and individuality of the reader, the presumptive privacy and individuality of the narrator, and especially the exclusivity of their relation to each other. Theatricality in Great Expectations, I'll be suggesting, does at least two things. It pulls against the novel's unparalleled sense of intimacy by suggesting that the private narrating self actually gives us a window onto a burgeoning public. And in some of the novel's strangest and most powerful moments, the theater exerts a pull not only away from the centrality of the narrating eye, but also away from the pyrotechnics, of Dickensian style itself. A theater is a space for performance, for applause, showing off, star turns, but it's also a space in which stories get told, but where no one owns the telling, a space where stories take place, but where, as Henry James put it, no character or narrator has a usurping consciousness. He's talking about Hamlet in that case, the fact that even though Hamlet is in a way the most psychologically complex character in theater, he has to just wait his turn to talk with everybody else. That's something about the way the theater works. You don't actually get to be inside Hamlet's head. because of the way the theater actually presents his story. In a play, this is James's point, even the hero has to take his turn with all the other agents in the story, no matter how small they may be. Both of these qualities, the assertive scene-stealing and the radically democratic imagination, are central, I think, to Dickensian theatricality. Now, if Great Expectations is the pinnacle of mature Dickens, it's no accident, I think, that this maturity is heralded by the most extended and apparently hostile treatment of theatrical performance anywhere in his work. Many of the novel's readers will remember the famous scene when Mr. Wopsle, an absurd clergyman Pip meets in childhood, makes a laughably awful performance in Hamlet, actually. But this is only the culmination of a series of theatrical scenes in the novel, a series that, taken as a whole, constitutes an extraordinary series of thought experiments on the project of novel writing and novel reading. What is a novel, Dickens is asking us in these scenes, and in particular, what is a novel when it is written in a confiding first person by an author whose imagination so closely resembles a theater? So I want to talk about some of those theatrical scenes with you. Wopsle's first theatrical indulgence is his prolonged live reading of George Lillo's 1731 tragedy, The London Merchant, a virtually forgotten play now, but one that was still performed quite a bit in the Victorian period. It's a kind of ridiculous melodrama about a murderous apprentice. Dickens uses the occasion of Wopsle reading this play to imagine a mode of artistic address that confirms the consumer's sense of being the private recipient of an all-important message. In the play, the apprentice George Barnwell is sent to the gallows after he and his prostitute lover, a woman named Millwood, plot and carry out the murder of his master. The plot is perfectly keyed to Pip's guilty self-understanding, and Wopsle's reading capitalizes on this to hint that Pip is somehow in danger of a fate similar to Barnwell's. At this point in the novel, Pip himself is actually an apprentice to his sister's husband, Joe, so there's sort of a reason why he might think he's connected to this idea of being a murderous apprentice, but it's otherwise a fairly ridiculous idea. Wopsle intends to read to Pumblechook, the equally absurd corn merchant who is also part of the landscape of Pip's childhood. But Pip tells us, "No sooner did he see me than he appeared to consider that a special providence had put apprentice in his way to be read at. And he laid hold of me and insisted on my accompanying him into the Pumblechookian parlor." The most bizarre feature of the scene that follows is the adult's ability to direct this reading so pointedly at Pip, to suggest that the bad behavior of a set of fictional characters somehow reflects on Pip's own character. So Pip feels himself incredibly intimately accused by what follows. Here's how Dickens describes the scene from Pip's perspective. "What stung me, as I listened to the reading of the play, was the identification of the whole affair with my unoffending self. When Barnwell began to go wrong, I declare that I felt positively apologetic. Pumblechook's indignant stare so taxed me with it. Wopsle, too, took pains to present me in the worst light. At once ferocious and maudlin, I was made to murder my uncle with no extenuating circumstances whatever. It became sheer monomania in my master's daughter to care a button for me. And all I can say from my gasping and procrastinating conduct on the fatal morning is that it was worthy of the general feebleness of my character. Even after I was happily hanged and Wopsle had closed the book, Pumblechook sat staring at me and shaking his head and saying, 'Take warning, boy, take warning,' as if it were a well-known fact that I contemplated murdering a near relation, provided I could only induce one to have the weakness to become my benefactor." Now, there's a lot going on in the passage, but I think the most important word in the passage is actually what seems like an unobtrusive preposition, at. Wopsle feels Pip has been put in his sight expressly in order to be read at. The word prompts us to ask what kind of address is natural to theatrical and novelistic utterance. Published fictional prose, of course, by definition addresses itself to a multitudinous audience. But the fantasy that it addresses each member of this unthinkably large audience singly is part of the effect of private reading, especially in the 19th century novel, which is famous for all of its addresses to a dear reader. It makes you feel like you're alone with that voice. Part of what's funny about Pip's perception of this episode, then, as well as uncanny, is the way it takes a genre, a play, whose address is overtly public, and renders it relentlessly personal. Novelistic narration, the episode suggests, is by definition internalizing, privatizing, virtually paranoid. The tendency of this novelistic narrator is to receive all material, even in the resistant medium of the drama, as fodder for his private psychodrama. This might seem like just a one-off joke, But I think you can see throughout the novel that this structure actually recurs over and over, where Pip takes things incredibly personally and we're not totally sure if he's right or out of his mind to do so. Dickens so constantly insinuates an "at" into the narrated action that we begin to suspect that Pip's most salient psychological characteristic is just this, his psychologization of everything, his ability to take all the world's facts personally. At Christmas dinner with Wopsle, Pumblechook, and some other absurd locals, the Hubbles, Pip observes, for example, that, quote, "they seem to think the opportunity lost if they fail to point the conversation at me every now and then and stick the point into me." Lots of prepositions kind of flying at him all of a sudden, even when no one's talking to him. "It began the moment we sat down to dinner. Mrs. Pumblechook shook her head and, contemplating me with a mournful presentiment that I should come to no good, asked, 'Why is it that the young are never grateful?' This moral mystery seemed too much for the company until Mr. Hubble tersely solved it by saying, 'Naturally wishes.' Everyone then murmured, 'True, true,' and looked at me in a particularly unpleasant and personal manner." Like the reading of The London Merchant, this scene works as a kind of reductio ad absurdum of the fantasy of private novelistic address, in which every general principle seems to have its ultimate destination in, well, you. If we understand these scenes as meditations on the conventions of novelistic address, we're left with a pretty grim vision of the novel as a form of claustrophobic intimacy. Pip's position suggests a world in which to read the words, "it was the best of times," is to feel personally congratulated, where to read the words, "it was the worst of times," is to feel intimately attacked. This is a universe, in other words, fantastically menaced with personal meaning, paranoid in precisely the same measure as it is comical. Now, Pumblechook and the Hubbles, the people who are responsible for this in the scenes I've just been reading, are, of course, malicious and insinuating. They're kind of evil characters in many ways. But I don't think we can explain the structure just by reference to these two characters' personalities. For that structure, where Pip feels himself to be referred to constantly, recurs in one of the most dreamlike moments in the novel, a crucial scene set in the village pub, where Pip encounters a convict whom Magwitch has sent as a messenger. The messenger is described marvelously as a secret-looking man, a phrase that sits nicely astride the issue of address. To be secret-looking, does it mean that the man looks as if he has a secret, that is, a secret for himself, or that he is looking at Pip as if he has something to tell, just him? Does he look secret, or is he looking secretly? Does his secrecy, we might say, turn inward or outward? Both seem to be the case here. When the man moves to deliver his message, he does so in a particularly unnerving way. Quote, "it was not a verbal remark, but a proceeding in dumb show, and was pointedly addressed to me. He stirred his rum and water pointedly at me, and he tasted his rum and water pointedly at me." Pip goes on to pinpoint the overtly unusual detail. The man is actually stirring his rum and water with a file to indicate his connection to the convict Magwitch. But I think the moment's uncanniness is already there, embedded in those repeated "ats," in the slightly odd idea that it's possible to stir your glass at someone, or to taste that glass's contents at someone. It's important that these pointed addresses are transmitted through the medium of a crowded public space, in fact, a public house, a pub, that is the local tavern known as the Three Jolly Bargemen. As with Wopsle's reading, then, here again we see a gesture that should be publicly available become imbued with a specific and very private meaning. As I've been suggesting, that gesture has that privacy in the midst of publicity in common with novelistic address itself, which similarly seems to speak to us with an intimate whisper, even through the clamorous world of print. So it's all the more striking that in both Wopsle's reading and in the rum and water stirring episodes, we find ourselves in the vicinity of theater. In Wopsle's reading, because his text is a play, and in the case of the secret-looking man, because his gesture is so clearly rehearsed. In fact, Dickens' peculiar phrasing in these scenes was anticipated in one of the century's most intriguing meditations on the nature of theatrical performance by Charles Lamb, the great Romantic era essayist, who wrote a terrific essay called Stage Illusion, published in 1825, but then republished many times over the course of the Victorian period as well. And Lamb's trying to figure out what it is about theatrical performance that defines theatrical performance. He approaches the mystery of performance by claiming that theatrical events are, quote, "done under the life or beside it, not to the life." He clarifies this somewhat abstract claim in the next couple sentences through the example of cowardly characters on the stage, The stage coward, he says, makes a perpetual sub-insinuation to us, the spectators, even in the extremity of the shaking fit, that he was not half such a coward as we took him for. We saw all the common symptoms of the malady upon him, the quivering lip, the cowering knees, the teeth chattering, and could have sworn that man was frightened. But we forgot all the while, or kept it almost a secret to ourselves, that he never once lost his self-possession, that he let out by a thousand droll looks and gestures meant at us, and not at all supposed to be visible to his fellows in the scene, that his confidence in his own resources had not deserted him. Lamb's language here, which I think is kind of remarkable in how weird it is, anticipates several of the key terms in the Dickens's passages we've been looking at. The actor in Lamb's account could be described as a secret-looking man in precisely the same ambiguous sense as Magwitch's emissary. He directs meaning at us, but he keeps this a secret from the other players, and we in turn keep it almost a secret to ourselves that this is even happening. Both Dickens and Lamb describe scenes of private messages transmitted through a dense social medium. Indeed, social messages whose function is partly to help us forget that the feeling of intimate address is in fact a fantasy. Lamb's most striking phrase makes use of that Dickensian preposition. Stage gestures, he claims, are meant at us. Lamb's emphasis reminds us that every instance of theatrical pretending is by the same token an instance of public address. An acted gesture implicitly convenes a collective body to witness it. What Lamb is registering here is the underlying formal promise of collective awareness that I think is always embedded in theatrical performance. And he suggests that what specifically defines the theater is that this collective awareness, this consciousness of the social medium that surrounds all meaning, never totally recedes from view. Theatrical pretending, in Lamb's account, always implies the bare fact of an audience's collective presence. We might then understand the theatricality of the world of Great Expectations. Dickens's habit of drawing our attention to the weirdness of private messages passing through public space as a way to make us aware of the fact that the novel's intimate address is itself a fiction. Or to put this another way, we might recognize that Pip is in fact a figure for us, a screen, that is, for the vast reading public that we're always part of, even when we feel incredibly intimately addressed by Dickens. This might at first sound counterintuitive. As I've said, Great Expectations is Dickens' most psychologically precise novel, his tightest first-person narration. The intimacy the reader feels with Pip is palpable, and it's intense. Great Expectations, we might say, is the most secret-looking of Dickens's books. But as with The Secret-Looking Man, this intimacy points two ways, both inward and outward. Pip's world, in which everyone seems to be playing at him, is, I think, a meditation on the peculiar theatricality of Dickensian style, which is always overtly playing to the public that lies right behind Pip, in a sense, gathered there behind his consciousness, seated at the aperture of his eyes. If we see Pip as a screen for our relations as readers to Dickens's prose, we can recognize that Pip's sense of being at the mercy of a world that menaces or delights him with secret intention is really a figure for the way Dickens's own prose always has us, its vast public, in its sights. The mist was heavier yet when I got out upon the marshes, Pip tells us in the novel's third chapter, so that instead of my running at everything, everything seemed to run at me. One answer to the question, what is Dickens, might be Dickens is a world that runs at us, or Dickens is a kind of writing, a writing at us. We've already seen that in this novel, scenes of theater become case studies for Dickens to reflect on the intensely personalizing fantasy that novels are written to us, and us particularly. But if we recognize that Dickens' style is also constantly theatricalizing this address, that is, rendering its public medium evident and inescapable, we will recognize, I think, other energies in this novel. A short while before we see Mr. Wopsle actually take the stage, Dickens recounts an evening at the Jolly Bargemen in which the former clerk entertains the company with a dramatic reading of a newspaper account of what Pip calls a highly popular murder. Wopsle is ridiculous, but he's also really effective at materializing the details of this crime. Dickens writes that, quote, Mr. Wopsle was imbrued in blood to the eyebrows. And even better, at inhabiting a range of voices and characters, Dickens continues, he identified himself with every witness at the inquest. He faintly moaned, I am done for, as the victim, and he barbarously bellowed, I'll serve you out, as the murderer. He gave the medical testimony in pointed imitation of our local practitioner, and he piped and shook as the aged turnpike keeper who had heard blows. He enjoyed himself thoroughly, and we all enjoyed ourselves and were delightfully comfortable. The first thing to notice about this scene is how it pivots the direction of address a full 180 degrees from the reading of the London Merchant that I started with. Where all the meanings of that earlier piece converged into an accusation directed at Pip, here Wopsle's performance redistributes identity and guilt, fundamentally altering the effect of a story whose point, it would seem, would be to isolate one particular criminal. This is actually a story about a murderer, a real murderer. And you would think this story would seem be even a better way to make Pip feel guilty and personally accused. But instead, in this scene, the guilt seems sort of redistributed and everybody's having a great time. The second thing to notice is how closely this description of Wopsle approximates those of Dickens at the massively popular stage readings of his work he had begun performing just a few years before he began writing Great Expectations. Like Wopsle imbrued in gore, Dickens' stage readings, as I mentioned at the beginning, came to their climax often with a blood-curdling rendition of Bill Sykes' Murder of Nancy from Oliver Twist. More notably, the alterations Dickens made to his text for the public readings mostly consisted, I think this is important, in striking out large chunks of his own narration. There's an example of the copy of the book version at the exhibit that William curated. You can actually see Dickens' own annotations to his copy of the reading version of Oliver Twist, and mostly what he's done is just crossed out anything that's not the character's talking. So in some sense, the violence he's doing to himself is really legible on the page. He's actually just crossing out Dickens so that the only people left are the people he invented. Of course, those are Dickens too, but there's something really intense about watching how violently he's actually stricken out Dickens. And eventually, in the readings, people would report that he would start reading as if he were Jonathan Franzen and then eventually just throw the book away and act out the murder, speaking Sykes, speaking Nancy, being those people. And I think there's something really important about that fact. If you look at those actual reading texts, they look a lot more like play texts than like novelistic texts. Dickens simply inhabited each of these characters with Wopsle-like virtuosity. We're beginning to see, I think, the curious way that Dickens' star turns were connected then to his disappearance. That these two facts, of the speaker's disappearance into his characters and the absence of a personalizing form of address, are related seems clear. But exactly how only begins to be revealed in the most extended piece of represented theater in Dickens' work, the episode in which Pip attends Wopsle's awful performance of Hamlet. Pip records every excruciating detail of Wopsle's costume, delivery, and posture, but the weirdest and funniest effects of the scene all have to do with Dickens' insistence on the literal nature of the performance space. We tend to associate the theatrical with the transcendence of the physical space in which it occurs, the ability to replace a closed and crowded room with a fairy kingdom or the Forest of Arden. But the theater here returns us with comical abruptness to the physical contours of reality. Almost all the jokes in the Hamlet sequence turn on various kinds of spatial proximity, of the audience to the stage or of onstage to offstage. Writing about the ghost of Hamlet's father, for example, in this particular performance, Dickens writes, "It was to be noted of this majestic spirit that whereas it always appeared with an air of having been out a long time and walked an immense distance, it perceptibly came from a closely contiguous wall." Meanwhile, the audience expresses its disapproval by asserting its spatial contiguity to the action. The badness of the performance is met with what Dickens calls a general indignation, taking the form of nuts. Wopsle's performance itself is one long occasion for Dickens to remind us of the audience's proximity to the action, as when a debating society arises in the audience during the to-be-or-not-to-be soliloquy, or when somebody in the gallery yells, "Waiter," when Wopsle daintily wipes his fingers after handling Yorick's skull, or when Laertes and Hamlet are said to be wrestling, quote, "on the brink of the orchestra and the grave." All the jokes are about the inability of this performance to keep the audience away from the action. The audience is always kind of like sticking its hands into the theater, into the performance space, and making it therefore look totally ridiculous. We get a clue, I think, to the reason for this obsessive interest in the literal space of performance in the final scene of narrated theater in the novel. Here Dickens is fascinated not only by the spatial proximity of the stage to the auditorium, but by the reversibility of sight lines that follows from that proximity, the fact that I, of course, can see you just as much as you can see me, even though officially you're here to see me, to your regret, perhaps. In our final glimpse of Wopsle's actorly career, this time in a downmarket Thameside theater specializing in bad melodrama and Christmas pantomime, it becomes suddenly unclear where exactly the stage is. Wopsle spends the majority of his time on stage, quote, staring in my direction, Pip's direction, as if he were lost in amazement. After the show, he informs Pip that he has recognized the other convict. We and Pip know him to be referring to Magwitch's nemesis, Compasson, seated right behind him in the audience, like Wopsle insists, a ghost. A theater etymologically is a space for seeing. While we usually assume that what is to be seen is the spotlit space of the stage, Dickens here gets maximum mileage out of the fact that the spatial closure of the theater, the way it conjoins a public and a troupe in the same place, also means, of course, that the sight lines can run both ways. A theater, in this sense, is a container for uncentered seeing, a space where both sight and subjectivity are universally distributed. I saw that you saw me. Pip's words to Wopsle right after that performance might be the law undergirding this theater. Everyone can see each other. This theater, in other words, has brought to its conclusion the trajectory we have been tracing through the novel's various representations of performance, from a world in which every story finds its destination in one lonely recipient, a world, that is, in which every story partakes of the fantasy of novelistic address, these are private messages intended for me, to a world in which the location and destination of address is radically decentered. I'm tempted to say that Great Expectations reaches a kind of closure in this scene, but I should be clear that I'm not using that term in the traditional sense. We tend to take closure as a temporal concept, a time concept. That is, we feel we get closure when we know the story is over. But it's worth recalling that, of course, the term derives from a spatial metaphor. Closure in the original sense refers not to what happens to individual characters, but to the more elementary fact of their being in the same place, their shared containment in the space of the work. We don't usually think of novels, I think, officially as kind of spatial objects, but I do think we pay kind of colloquial tribute to that when we talk about things that happen in novels or really characters who are in novels. For example, I think it's not a totally uncommon experience to talk about Great Expectations, for example, as a novel that has a frozen in time spinster, Miss Havisham, a blacksmith with a heart of gold, and an eerily professional lawyer in it. Even if we can't exactly recall these characters' relation to one another or what happens to any of them, but we know they're all in there. They're inside there as if it was a kind of box or a theater indeed. Dickens's constant references to theatrical space reminds us that a theater can never pretend not to be a place, a space for social congregation that is the real ground of whatever story takes place there. So the importance of space in the last two represented theaters in the novel, I think, bears directly on the question, on the issue of the solipsism of the self, the narcissism of perception. As the novel's title indicates, Pip's delusions are perhaps constituted by a temporalizing way of looking at the world. That is, his delusions are embedded in the very posture of expectation, his sense that the universe's message will be revealed to him in time. But one of the lessons the novel teaches Pip, maybe the most important lesson, is about the inability of time to insulate him from the spaces he believes he's left behind. Compasson and all he represents are literally in the room with him. For many readers, I suspect the experience of completing Great Expectations is one of radical closure in precisely this sense, the overwhelming sensation that a world we thought was mysteriously large is in fact closed, interconnected in startling, even claustrophobic ways. For me, the weirdest instance of this is the fact that I can never remember the fact, this is a spoiler if you haven't read it, but if you're like me, you'll forget this as soon as I say it, that Estella, the girl we think is going to take him away from the marshes and completely the fantasy of this classy girl he's going to marry, take him into London society, is, of course, at the end of the novel revealed not only to be not going to marry him, but actually Magwitch's daughter. In other words, the two halves of the novel that we think are so discrepant are, in fact, genealogically the same damn plot. Every time I get there, I forget that I'm like, oh my God, she's actually Magwitch's daughter. They're the same. It's the tightest little world you could possibly imagine. It's like impossible to meet anybody new in this world. The only people you can meet are, and you forget. I always forget immediately, so you will forget this now too. But I think it's important. It feels like a really small book, which is a very weird thing to say about Dickens, who feels like the world is so big usually when you read him. So not only do Pip's expectations not lead him away from his boyhood traumas, they are overtly contiguous with them. These facts, I think, link the novel's ethical correction of Pip's delusions to the spatial container of the theater. Our ghosts are sitting right behind us. Indeed, they might not even really be ghosts. So I've been arguing that the novel's meditation on the ways we deny the existence of the world's otherness, its difference from ourselves, is routed through Dickens's scenes of theater. And these theatrical set pieces allow Dickens to think about the solipsism that's embedded in narrative point of view, especially in first-person narration. And I've suggested that the spaces he conjures in this final theater is a space of universal seeing, where the stability of sight lines is impossible to establish and where co-presence trumps the privileges of perspective. It doesn't really matter where you sit in this theater because we're all in it. This theater, that is, reveals that the world does indeed have a message for Pip, just as he had all along suspected, but the message is that his specialness is an illusion. This theater stands as a corrective not only to Pip, but to his very status as a novelistic hero, as an eye who centers our perception. This theater is, I think, a revelation of the distortions inherent in the very awareness of having a self. Three moments, then, before I stop, moments, I think, of intense beauty and intense ethical interest that stage variations on what we might mean when we speak of Dickensian theatricality. The first occurs at the end of the novel's first volume, over a series of sentences I misunderstood entirely my first time through this novel. Pip is leaving home, leaving his home in the provinces to go to London, and regretting that he has failed to say goodbye properly to Joe, the blacksmith who's essentially raised him. Dickens writes, "I deliberated with an aching heart whether I would not get down when we changed horses and walk back and have another evening at home and a better parting. We changed, and I had not made up my mind, and still reflected from my comfort that it would be quite practicable to get down and walk back when we changed again. We changed again, and yet again, and it was now too late and too far to go back." And by the time I'd reached the end of this passage, I'd forgotten entirely that Pip is riding in a stagecoach and that the changing of which he speaks is the changing of horses as he passes from one stage of his journey to the other. With no horses in my head, the words just struck me as a startlingly modern kind of poetry. But my mistake, of course, wasn't only a mistake, since I was hearing the allegorical tones that Dickens has planted there. And then I was reconfirmed in this sense that my mistake wasn't totally a mistake when I got to the next words on the page. Immediately following the words I've just cited is the curious sentence that signals the end of the first volume. This is the end of the first stage of Pip's expectations. It's a very weird way to refer to the end of a volume of no volumes of novels in Victorian literature call it the stage. They might say end of book one or, you know, end of part one, but nobody calls it a stage. I don't think it's unintentional. It seems important that the word Dickens chooses points both to a temporal concept and a spatial one. At the very moment, in other words, that Dickens draws our attention to the tight developmental architecture of this particular novel, the way it follows Pip through three sharply distinguished temporal stages, he also uses a word, stage, of course, that suggests not one character's particular journey, but a closed theatrical space where everyone runs into one another. And for me, anyway, it's less the incantatory rhythm of the passage that is moving than it is the quiet waning of the first-person pronoun, as the text's psychological tightness opens on a collective subject, a subject moving through time together and becoming different from itself together. We changed, we changed, we changed again, and yet again. Second moment, the hinge between chapters 55 and 56. This is very late in the novel. We've been following Pip's attempts to get Magwitch out of England after he's reappeared on pain of death. They've capsized on the River Thames. It's a terrible terrible catastrophe, and the recaptured Magwitch lies in prison and close to death when the proceedings are interrupted for some comedy. And it strikes a really weird note, I think. Chapter 55 recounts Wemmick's marriage to Miss Skiffins. Wemmick, as many of you will know, is Dickens's famous emblem of the split personality demanded by modern work, rigidly correct in his professional existence as a clerk for the tough-as-nails lawyer, Jaggers, and impossibly loving and open-hearted the minute he steps across the moat that surrounds his home in the suburb of Walworth. Wemmick is famous for this kind of a ridiculous split in professional behavior. He's not really on our minds at this point in the novel. In fact, we're really paying attention to Magwitch and what's about to happen to him. He's lying near death, and all of a sudden, chapter 55 switches to this kind of cute marriage. And it's a totally jarring moment, I think, in the book, and I think it's sort of meant to be. Chapter 55 ends with yet another winking allusion, and there's been a lot of them by this point in the novel, to Wemmick's schizophrenic existence, as he confides his love for his wife to Pip and hastens to add, "This is altogether a Walworth sentiment, please. Mr. Jaggers may as well not know of it. He might think my brain was softening," or something of the kind. Now, the episode is impossible not to be amused by, but I also think impossible to be more than mildly amused by, arriving as it does in the very middle of the novel's ethical climax. Our mind is on something else, and it's sort of the last time you want to hear like a cute Dickensian joke about Wemmick, or at least that's how I feel about it. The next words on the page are the heading Chapter 56, followed by what I think are a set of astonishing sentences. He lay in prison very ill during the whole interval between his committal for trial and the coming round of the sessions. He had broken two ribs, they had wounded one of his lungs, and he breathed with great pain and difficulty, which increased daily. It was a consequence of his hurt that he spoke so low as to be scarcely audible. Therefore, he spoke very little. As in the previous passage, it's a pronoun here that takes on such strange vibrancy, a he not preceded by any proper name. It takes us a second to realize that we're talking about Magwitch, not Wemmick, but it takes us a second. If the novel began in a first person so voracious as to make us suspect that Magwitch was merely an effect of that narrator's need, here we see that first person recede into invisibility. And as moving as Magwitch's plight is, it's even more so when we recall that he was originally conjured as a way to apprehend or to deny the world in its otherness. It is as if, in quietly recording the damage done to this body, the narration has for the first time left behind the limitations of self to witness the world's otherness in its living and its dying distinctiveness. I don't think it's an accident that Pip's surrender of narrative centrality coincides with the muting of Dickensian comic energy, almost as if this narration has become tired of its own routines. The undeniable beauty of the sentences I've just read derives from their sheer plainspokenness, and I take that plainspokenness as evidence of the will of this comic stylist of overwhelming gifts to surrender momentarily his personality. Along with Pip's eye, what disappears briefly in both passages is a familiar Dickensian magic, a disappearance that in the process makes way for a seeing whose impersonal witnessing we can only call austere, modest, reticent, not words we associate with Dickens, but I think maybe we should. Is this too a Dickensian theater, a theater of a wholly other kind? He and we, pronouns respectively of externality and collectivity, pronouns that is that condition the world of the theater, where no one's eye can focus our understanding of events, where every individual can be seen and must only be seen from the outside, and where we can only witness the action or imagine entering it under conditions of radical collectivity. Third and final moment. A few pages later, in Chapter 56, Magwitch is sentencing. He's among a bunch of other criminals, 31 of them, in fact, and the judge is about to issue the sentence of death. A great gallery of people, a large theatrical audience, looked on. The sun was striking in at the great windows of the court, through the glittering drops of rain upon the glass, and it made a broad shaft of light between the 2 and 30 and the judge, linking both together, and perhaps reminding some among the audience how both were passing on with absolute equality to the greater judgment that knoweth all things and cannot err. Conjoined in this extraordinary passage are not just the accused and the law, but also the audience that bears witness to their conjunction and in the process is included in that merger. The light that joins these beings in the passage I've just read is overtly theological, but it should make us think not only of a Christian God, but of the author of these fictional creatures. This is explicitly a scene of theater. He actually calls it a theatrical audience, the only scene so labeled in the novel that does not occur in an actual performance space. And in it, we see a godlike virtuosity, that is Dickens, aspire to become nothing more than the illumination for the beings it has made. If this is also, of course, a moment of Dickensian stylistic brilliance, it seems to me that this virtuosity is here imagining its own disappearance. This is, I think, the strangest affordance of Dickensian theatricality, the fantasy that this voice, perhaps the most distinctive in the history of the English novel, might evaporate to become the lighting for a stage of absolute equality. Thanks. Thank you. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. No, I didn't do anything. I just did it to myself.
You can't tell.
If there's any questions, I'm happy to talk or not. Yeah.
Figure. Even the setting is before he was born, she's wearing a costume.
Sure, yeah. The question is about Satis House, which is where Miss Havisham lives with Estella, and where, you know, famously, it is absolutely, you're totally right, it's the most obvious theatrical place in the novel. The question was about that being the most theatrical space in the novel, given that Miss Havisham has, like, prepared this scenario for Pip. Or not for Pip, in fact, but she's prepared it, and it seems to be Pip mistakes that. And I think, similar to the ways I'm talking about here, he thinks it's about him. Of course, it's not. Right, he always thinks it's about him, of course. I mean, one of the weirdest things about that thing is, again, I always forget that, of course, it's not like when you get jilted on your wedding night, you actually, everything's, like, your clocks stop, you know? In other words, you have to kind of prepare that mise-en-scene kind of carefully. But one tends to think of it just like, the world froze for her. But, of course, probably she had to go home afterward and, like, you know, get everything ready, you know, like stop the clocks, put everything back to the moment it happened. And so it's a very prepared scenario, yeah. I think it's the same exact structure. I mean, what I was focusing on was slightly less, that's a much more about his romantic expectations and his class aspiration, but I think it's exactly the same structure, you're right. I think it might change it, even it's much more a feminized space. But I think it's a structure we see over and over, where every time he sees a theater, he thinks it's a novel, or he thinks he's the star of the theater. Yeah, to an extent, yeah. But I also think the novel, as I was trying to say, I suppose, I think Dickens is thinking about the kind of scene-hogging thing of that. And I think what's so moving about the novel to me is is that Pip actually surrenders that centrality. It is about the discovery of the centrality, of his lack of centrality. It's one of the reasons the novel's so hard to sort of criticize, in a sense. It's, you know, a lot of criticism has said Pip's fortunes rely on the unrecognized work of working class people, or of the colonial world, which is totally true, except that when we do that, we're actually just repeating the plot of the novel, which is it's about not knowing where your money comes from, not knowing where your support and love come from, and then realizing, oh my God, I'm a total shit. I haven't realized who's supporting me, who's working for me. So it's a very hard structure to get out of, and I think it's kind of given us our terms for recognizing that. You know, you're like, I thought this was all just happening, and it turns out, no, somebody's paying the bill, somebody's worked really hard for this, and it's not who you thought it was either. It's kind of ugly when you look at it, who you're actually relying on. But no, it's a great point. Thank you.
Going back to some of the more psychological points the novel makes, my understanding, let's say, because I now look upon Pip in some ways as an abused child. Mm-hmm. You know, his sister really, really, you know, put one over on him. And sometimes it happens when children are abused from a very young age, they become very self-conscious. They become very self-conscious and think that every criticism, every point, everything that happens is specifically pointed at them, because sometimes the abused child, at some point, the abuser blames them for everything. They become very self-conscious. And so I think there is a certain psychological reason why Pip becomes very, it becomes apparent to him that everything in his life is about him. Mm-hmm. Because that is a common reaction of an abused child to abuse. Mm-hmm. They become very self-conscious. They think everything does relate to them.
Yeah. Did you guys hear the question, or should I repeat it?
No.
You did. It's about whether this is really about Pip's psychology as an abused child, essentially, and that his paranoia derives from that. I think for sure, yeah. The only thing I would add or change about that is just that becomes most interesting for me when we realize that, I mean, Dickens is so great at seeing what's general and what might seem sort of pathologically specific. In other words, to me, that just, in a way, sounds like the structure of subjectivity, right? Like, you think it's about you because you think your pain is worse than everyone else's. And of course, that's not to say that abused children don't have different kinds of psychological outcomes than others, right? But it is to say that I think everybody in Dickens is, like, psychologically completely messed up. If you actually think of them as real people, especially the, like, normal people or the happy people, you know, like Tiny Tim, who's like, oh, don't worry, I'll just die, it's fine. I mean, these people are like, it's masochistic and self-abuse and in strange, or Esther Summerson jiggling her keys constantly. I mean, she's some kind of neurotic Stepford wife. It's insane, you know? So if you actually pay attention to these people, but they all are sort of representative of something bigger than themselves, I think. And that's what's so interesting about Pip, is that it's impossible not to identify with that sense of injured, being injured, at least maybe for me.
Of
course, yeah.
If you wonder about Dickens' own childhood.
Well, yeah, Dickens' childhood, of course, is famously structured by a similar sense of... It's kind of interesting, there's a debate about Dickens whether... Not debate exactly, but, you know, the biographers talk about the big event, the big abusive event was being... When his father was taken to prison for debt, was that he was forced to work in the blacking factory, Warren's blacking factory, for several months. It was a real terrifying experience of, like, being declassed, being a working-class kid when he thought he had other expectations. So, of course, he felt abused by this, by his parents. But, you know, there's other people say that there are more terrifying forms of childhood trauma. You know, it's a pretty serious one, but the way it got refracted in the literature, if you understand the literature that way, it's, you know, people get, like, the crap beat out of them all in Dickens, and that never seemed to happen to Dickens, actually. He spent a couple months thinking he was not going to be a middle-class kid. But in the scale of things that happened in the Victorian London, there were much worse things, you know, and we know about them mostly because he invented characters to whom those bad things happened. But I think you're totally right, yeah.
Do you find these theatrical themes and cues in other Dickens or all of Dickens' novels?
Yes, I guess. I don't know. I mean, of course, yeah. I mean, I haven't thought about them as much in other novels, but they're totally there, yeah. Even when they're not, it's not, I mean, you know, Nicholas Nickleby, he spends a lot of time, Nicholas himself spends a lot of time with a traveling theater company, so there's a lot there, but even ones where theater is not explicitly invoked, I mean, everybody acts, that was the big criticism of Dickens, is that he doesn't really write novels, he writes plays with, you know, characters who are hamming it up all the time. In a old curiosity shop with the, what's his name? Quilp. I mean, it's like, these are characters who, Quilp, the little evil dwarf who, like, when he's alone, he'll, like, run up the walls and, like, rub his hands. And, I mean, he's acting like he's on a stage, you know, but he's performing for someone. Of course, he's performing for us. But all the characters in Dickens are constantly talking to themselves and chuckling to themselves and making little gestures to themselves and doing things that are totally absurd from a psychological point of view, actually. But from a theatrical point of view, it's the only way to understand them, yeah. So, yeah, totally. It's all over the place. Yeah.
I was wondering if you or if other critics have ever been inclined to look at Great Expectations as an autumnal novel of sorts, the same way that, say, Persuasion is considered to be Jane Austen's autumnal novel, because it does come rather late in his career. And then, in keeping with your own interests, I'm wondering if the autumnal features of the novel, if they do exist, whether they intersect with the theatricality.
Yeah, the question was about whether I or anybody has thought of it as an autumnal novel in the sense that Austen's Persuasion is an autumnal novel, a late novel, and how that would intercept with my ideas about the waning of the person, I suppose. That's a great idea. Yeah, I think. I first experienced this novel in an academic context with in a class with Eve Sedgwick, the late terrific literary critic, and she had her point about the narrative voice was that it was kind of a posthumous voice. And also that Pip is an uncle, that I took that from her, that by the end he's become a kind of ghost to his own existence. And I think that has a lot in common with what I'm seeing as the kind of waning of the self, yeah, that's sort of definitive of his personality in a way. I think that it is a novel about death in some ways. He kind of is dead in a way, in a kind of beautiful way by the end of the novel, actually. It's sort of a consoling disappearing,
A lot of people have commented on how Dickens seemed to predict film, predict a lot of the effects in film. And I'm not just talking about the way he uses visuals, but also the way he cross-cuts.
The question is about you know, the idea that Dickens anticipated film not only in his sort of visual style, but also in the narrative cross-cutting. Yeah, I mean, I haven't thought much about it except, I mean, I think I feel like Dickens anticipated TV more than film in the sense of, I feel like Dickens invented, like, HBO in particular. You know, I mean, I'm not the only person to think that, of course, but that, you know, people often said that, you know, it's specifically like what happened when DVDs came out, which is that you could start to think of TV as something that you would experience serially, but then also purchase and own as a kind of set and experience and think about the season as an arc. I mean, that structure is specifically that's the Victorian novel. You know, it was experienced serially, and then you could also, after spending 2 years with it, like buy the box set and read it and enjoy it. But that is the exact same structure of experiencing a fiction. So I think he absolutely invented that, you know, that particular form of managing big narratives. He is like the pinnacle of that particular cultural form, yeah. But other people have thought a lot more about that, so I can tell you who they are later. Yeah.
You'll love this comment. My 15-year-old nephew, while reading Great Expectations in high school, was this a miniseries? What?
Well, of course it is. It's like 4 miniseries, right? Yeah.
Do you have any additional thoughts about Hamlet? Did Dickens want us to think of Pitt as Hamlet in some way? I mean, you spoke about Pitt's world as being solipsistic, that he couldn't meet anyone new. You spoke of agency. And other critics have commented on his passiveness. I mean, how far are we going to look for at a Pitt Hamlet now?
Well, his question is about Hamlet and how much we're supposed to think of Pip as Hamlet. I mean, a lot of people have made that connection. It's really there to be made, I think, absolutely. And, you know, I think Hamlet's like the irresistible, in a way. I didn't write about this in the book I just wrote, but I should have more. I mean, Hamlet's the obvious sort of in-between point as a character for novel and theater, because he's famously, in many claims about Shakespeare or about modernity, he's like the first interiorized psychological character. And the irony of that, of course, is that he's a character in a play. That's the Henry James thing I quoted earlier. He says even in Hamlet, who we think of as the most interiorized character, the fact that he's in a play means that the gravedigger, he has the same sort of status as the gravedigger on some level, right? They all get to talk, even though, of course, Hamlet's a more important character, he's more psychologically complex, but a play is a really weird place for Hamlet to show up. So I think it's totally right that we're supposed to think of that, I mean, both in terms of his hesitation and all that stuff, but also just in terms of his psychology, that he's a psychological character who's also part of a bigger world, as Hamlet is. And this is also James Joyce's obsession with Hamlet is very similar. It's about, is Hamlet like a psychological character or not? And that's all through Ulysses as well. The second thing, of course, is just that Joyce is really funny on this, is that Hamlet, everybody's obsessed with Hamlet as some kind of psychological play, not only because of Hamlet, but also that it'll somehow give us the key to Shakespeare. So you can read about the author's biography by reading Hamlet. There's a character in Ulysses who says, oh, Hamlet is so personal. You know, it's really a private paper about the author's life. But exactly what it's saying about Shakespeare is kind of weird. So people say like, oh, well, you can tell that he was really, you can tell that he didn't really like his wife because, you know, Hamlet doesn't like his mother. I mean, it's absurd. You can't really figure out too much about Shakespeare from reading Hamlet. But it's a total temptation to psychologize based on Hamlet all the time. So I think it's totally, it's an important connection, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he did. I mean, this novel, he changed not because the audience objected. Well, his first audience, his editor, didn't like the first ending, which is, you know, that Pip and Estella. Estella marries this hideous guy who beats her, apparently, and Pip sees her in London one day, and they say hi, and that's it. And the guy was like, too much of a downer, you got to get them married at the end, which is completely preposterous given the way the novel feels. You know, the whole point is that he doesn't get to marry Estella. So he rewrote it so that they would ridiculously run into each other at Sada's house. I mean, like hundreds of miles from where, or at least 100 miles from where either of them lives, they're both just walking around one day. It's like meeting your childhood sweetheart at your like elementary school 30 years later, being like, hey, you're here too, let's get married. That's exactly what happens. So he did respond to that pressure. And, you know, he did respond to other, you know, the portrait of, the most famous example I think that I know of is the portrait of Fagin and Oliver Twist, so anti-Semitic. In later editions, he changed the words the Jew, which he's referred to all the way just to Fagin. It makes a difference, actually, if you read the text. You know, it's like, he's a pretty despicable character, but calling him Fagin is slightly less icky than just like the Jew said. And then in a slightly not such a successful response to that criticism, because he had a lot of criticism, especially from an American correspondent about Fagin. He wrote a really nice Jewish character in Our Mutual Friend, is it? Yeah, of course, you guys know better than I do. So sure, he absolutely did. And of course, the whole thing, I mean, I feel like, you know, less specifically, I mean, of course, he's working with his audience's expectations around what can be represented, what can't be represented. A lot of people think Great Expectations is like a failed Bildungsroman. It's not really in the tradition of like a novel of education because there's no sex in it. It's like you got this young, you know, English guy, 19th century England, with a lot of money, having a lot of parties, but the parties don't really, in France, you know what's happening at those parties, you know, but Pip is just like getting really drunk and having a lot of food and then being like, oh, I feel so crazy. But of course, you know, he wasn't able to do that because of the Victorian conventions where you couldn't really represent your hero doing that. Thackeray came closer to representing Pendennis, his character, actually at least, you know, flirting and maybe getting involved in sexual stuff. So sure, there's all kinds of pressures on his, what he writes.
Yeah,
there's another character. No, there are characters. No, that's what I mean. The other part of the answer to your question, I suppose, would be that there is all that stuff in Dickens. It's just not, it's hard to kind of, you have to kind of look for it, or it's on the periphery, or it's not frontally owned. But I mean, yeah, there are like adulteresses in Dickens. They're some of the best characters, of course, and there are these kind of brutal sexuality, yeah, with Drummle. He's particularly scary. And of course, I mean, there's a lot even in this novel that's quite intense, but it's usually displaced from the characters we're supposed to like embrace. You know, most famously when little Emily and David Copperfield, the fact that she falls and has sex out of wedlock, she sort of recuperated at the end, but she has to go live in Australia. That's like, you can't stay in England if you did that. You can be forgiven and welcomed, but and welcome back into the family, but then the family has to go to Australia. So that's about as, you know, there are limits to what can be incorporated. That's it. Should we stop?
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. We'll see you next Wednesday, I hope. Have a good evening.